Danielle Stevenson, who is a mycoregeneration specialist. She uses mushrooms to regenerate the soil, to take toxins out of the soil. You do mycoremediation. So what is a food systems consultant?
I have done a lot of work, everything from farming myself, doing permaculture, design myself, mushroom cultivation, mushroom farming, to working on different aspects that are important in the food system, like food access, education, building food literacy, making sure everyone's getting access to healthy food to eat and has the skills to, grow it, and resources to grow their own food and access food. And everything from also, food waste and food recovery and community kitchens and all kind of stuff like that, food banks. So I've worked in all these areas of the food system, and so I've kind of consulted on a lot of projects, again, with everyone from neighborhood houses and community centers to farmers directly to, big-scale food distributors. So kind of worked on all aspects of the food system.
All right, yeah, we're familiar with that. We have a lot of that going on up here, too. So what is healing city soils? I'm just going through your bio here, and then we'll get into the questions that
we
discussed.
Yeah, so actually, I'm glad you asked about healing city soils, because that's actually how I got into mushrooms. So I was doing all this urban agriculture work and working with, elementary schools and helping them, kids grow food and learn about environmental sustainability. And I started finding out that a lot of these farms and gardens that we were helping set up around the city were contaminated with toxic metals like lead. And so I was like, man, what do we do about that? And I heard that fungi, I didn't know anything about fungi, but I saw that famous TED Talk by Paul Stamets about ways mushrooms can save the world, and I was like, all right, okay, I need to learn about fungi, because they can help, deal with soil contamination and build healthy soil. But as I started to explore different types of, community-based mycobio-phyto remediation, I became aware that, testing, lab testing for contaminants was a huge barrier, right? Most people, it's expensive. If you don't have a scientific background, it can be difficult to understand the results. And so I founded Healing City Soils, which offers free soil contaminant testing for people growing food.
Wow.
To address that gap. We not only provide free soil testing, but also help understanding the results and figuring out through workshops and fact sheets what to do if you have soil contamination.
Right, and so raised beds is not the solution that we permaculturists came up with was raised beds, but that's just not, eventually I imagine the toxins are going to leach up into a raised bed. All right, so moving on is arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi and photo extraction. Can you give me a little bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. So, mycorrhizal fungi, first of all, myco means fungal, rhizal is related to roots. So these are fungi that live in symbiotic or mutually beneficial relationships with plants, and almost all plants on Earth have these fungal friends at their roots, helping them grow. And so in my research right now, I'm a grad student in California in environmental toxicology, and I look at how these plant friend fungi interact with toxic metals, mostly in agricultural systems where we don't, of course, want toxic metals getting taken up into the crops that we eat, the foods that we eat. But there's a double kind of benefit there, because a lot of plants are used in what's called phytoremediation or phytoextraction, where we actually work with, you may be familiar with, like hyperaccumulator plants that through their roots are really great at pulling up a whole lot of minerals and nutrient elements, but also really often accumulate toxic metals too. So these same mycorrhizal fungi also help phytoextractor plants live and grow on highly contaminated sites so that they can do that work of pulling up those metals. So, it's kind of neat that in these different contexts, in, you know, contaminated sites, these arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi help plants take out more toxic metals. And then in agricultural sites, they seem to be able to actually block toxic metals from getting up into our foods.
Wow.
So it's really curious. Yeah.
Well, so I'm familiar with, you're familiar with the Arcata sewage treatment plant in Arcata, California. They have cattail marsh in there that does what you're saying, takes up the metals into the plant. But this is the first I've heard that you can actually, so the fungi can actually block the toxins from getting into the plant that we may eat. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. And the thing with metals, just to, I think a helpful bit of information there is that, you know, we all know there's a whole lot of different kinds of contaminants that we've polluted the waters and the land with, right? So there's organic contaminants that are made out of something that was alive at one point. So, like, you know, fossil fuels, petroleum products, plastics, they actually are all made from, some, you know, from the dead bodies of something that was once alive.
Right, they're carbon-based.
Yeah, exactly. They're carbon-based, and so that means there's probably some kind of microbe that'll eat it, you know, be able to utilize it for food and break it down and or transform it in doing so. But the problem with metals is that they're inorganic. They're elemental. They cannot be broken down. They can change forms to be less mobile, like less likely to move around in our water and in our get up into our crops and stuff. But, you know, we've mined metals and deposited them all over the place, and they don't break down. So they're just, it's a problem because they accumulate, including in our, you know, agricultural soils, in our backyard soils. They're there. So we need to find a way to deal with them.
All right, well, we'll get into that more in a minute. Let's just pitch the Association for Women Scientists and the Foundation for Food and Agriculture, if you want to just briefly pitch those.
Yeah, sure. So, I'm involved in the Association for Women in Science. I think it's really important to, you know, elevate and acknowledge all the contributions to science that women and also just like all kinds of underrepresented groups in science have made. So that's what that's about. The Foundation for Food and Agriculture is a leadership fellowship focused on solving these big problems that we're facing globally around, like, you know, feeding the world with, you know, at the same time as there's these environmental challenges from climate change to environmental pollution that are making that hard. So, I'm involved in that as a fellow through my work, as we've already discussed, looking at how these fungi can actually help reduce toxic stuff in our food.
All right, so let's get back. I'm sorry to bounce you around, but I've never understood at the Arcata treatment plant what happens when like you're saying, the plants don't use these metals. They just take them up as part of their structure. Is that correct? So what happens, so are we diluting these metals so that they're less harmful? Or what happens to the metals when they are taken up by the fungi or the plant?
That's a great question. It depends. So, in a system like the one you're describing, right? It sounds like it's a wastewater treatment facility.
Correct. Yeah.
Did you say? Okay. Right. So, yeah. So I mean, cattails, presumably they're like sucking up those metals, and they're, as you say, holding them in their tissues, in their, you know, plant tissues. So, the water that would be moving through that system would be kind of getting the metals vacuumed out of them by these cattails. There's other, you know, and that kind of strategy of what would maybe be called immobilization, you're right, you're not, you know, resolving the issue altogether. The metals are still present in that system, but they're just, the main point is trying to reduce exposure to the metals. That exposure to for humans and for other organisms is what causes harm and health problems. So if they're bound up in the plant matter, then they're not causing harm. And that's an approach that, like, immobilization, whether in fungal biomass underground or, you know, in plant tissues, is one strategy. Another is to actually remove the plants. So you would, you know, have the plants in the system, they would extract metals, and then you would actually harvest all those plants, effectively removing the metals from that site. What I've done in the past is anaerobically composted down that plant matter so that you end up going from a huge area that has been contaminated with metals, getting them sucked up into the plants, all that plant biomass becomes like this sludge, a small amount of concentrated metals in sludge that you can then either dispose of to a hazardous waste disposal facility, or you can kind of steward and keep in a completely sealed environment on the site. But either way, you've cleaned the site in a sense, and cleaned a large area, ending up with just a small amount of metals. And in fact, there's some neat stuff. Something that really fascinates me is the potential, like, what do you do with that, you know, contaminated plant matter, say, or fungal matter, say, that you have used in a remediation project? And there's a lot of potential to actually, like, make useful stuff out of it. So, you know, sometimes trees are used to suck up metals, they store them in their heartwood, and then you can, like, harvest those trees decades later and make furniture. And again, the issue is exposure, but when you're sitting on a chair that, you know, is varnished and may have some metals in its heartwood, you're not going to be exposed to them. Likewise, you know, people are getting all into mica objects, so, like, objects made out of fungal mycelium, and, you know, that's also a possibility, you know, with mycelium that's been used in remediation projects.
Some word that you used just occurs to me. I don't suppose you can ferment the you said you take the biomass. I think it was the biomass word, is that what you used? You know, you can't put it in like a methane digester and, in other words, create something, a fuel out of it, but then skim off the metals. And now you have the metal in its original form.
Current, you're on to something. That's a great idea, and someone should explore that. Yeah, you, definitely. The process I described
anaerobic
is basically fermentation.
Right.
But absolutely, why not see if that could be some kind of fuel? But the second piece you offered there is right on. I mean, you know, actually, fungi, because of their strong ability to, you know, like, bind up metals in some way, they're often used even to re-extract or, like, harvest precious metals from, you know, from, like, electronic waste and things like that. So, yeah, and, you know, I've seen, there was a cool article that came out pretty recently about extracting precious metals from plants that are used in phytoremediation. So I think that's a great idea, and I think that's kind of the future. Like, we need to clean up all the pollution that we've spread everywhere. And if we can not only clean it up in ecologically friendly ways that create, you know, useful, like, stuff, like fuels or furniture or things that we need, why not, you know, recycle?
I'm into appropriate technology, and then if it would be within a cycle, then the metals would become part of a cycle. And it just reminds me of, you know, where is it that all the computer waste goes to? Some third world country, and they have little kids walking around picking through the computer waste. So maybe it could be used there. Well, so let's move on, because what you're saying too is, we're some environment. We have a lot of primitivists up here. We have, we have John Zerzan is a primitivist anarchist. And so he does not like a technology at all. There's people up here that don't like technology. I'm into appropriate technology. So the question, you know, what do you say to environmentalists that there's some anarchists and environmentalists that don't believe in bioremediation because they just want to stop using technology completely? You know, what do you say to polluters? Like, can we do this with Union Carbide and Bhopal and the Horizon, things like that? Can it be used to clean that up? But would then polluters be encouraged to pollute more because there is a solution?
I really appreciate this thoughtful question, and I think it's really important to consider the consequences of our actions, right? And so I fully wholeheartedly believe and am involved in, like, organizing to stop harmful and destructive and polluting practices. And so I don't advocate for bioremediation as a kind of way to facilitate or enable, you know, ongoing destructive and extractive industrial practices. And so the reason I advocate for, like, these types of remediation are because I think it's an important kind of harm reduction while we're also working on holding the companies accountable for the destruction. The problem is that a lot of times the companies are not held accountable in any way for the pollution and destruction and over-extraction that's happened. And the people, there's a lot of human and ecological communities that are left with that toxic legacy, and that leads to a lot of harm. And because I care a lot about people and ecologies, I really advocate developing and sharing these kind of grassroots tools of working with nature to clean up pollution, because the reality right now is that as we keep advocating for these companies and such to be held accountable, a lot of people are getting sick and just living in places where there's been this pollution left behind. So I think it's a harm reduction approach. I don't mean it to advocate to enable destruction, but more to reduce the harm that's caused and is caused in an ongoing way that a lot of communities are facing. Disproportionately, I'll say, too, right? So,
how is
it? I think it's, like, complementary.
How is it implemented? I mean, at the risk of sounding harsh, I mean, sounding like a capitalist, is there would a public entity charge a polluter and make them pay a nonprofit to do this work? Is that the business model, or what? How is this stuff implemented?
You've hit on some of the challenges in implementing this. So the conventional approach to remediation is done by companies, often companies that are, you know, connected in some way to, like, the industry that did the polluting in the first place.
Bechtel.
It's all the same kind of crew. And
Halliburton.
So the problem is, or developers. So I became aware when I started doing remediation work that, you'd have like a developer. First you'd have an industry that would extract all they could from an area. Then you'd have developers come in and basically flatten the area and try to build condos or something on it.
Like mountaintop mining.
They would hire engineering companies to do the remediation. The remediation would involve just digging up the contaminated soil and disposing of it at a contaminated waste disposal, like a dump. And all of those people like know each other and are like, hey buddy, I got a contract for you. Can you know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, it was all connected. And that doesn't, it kind of gets back to the raised bed thing a bit, where it doesn't really address the problem, right? It just moves it somewhere else. It externalizes it, which is why I think the world has been destroyed through capitalism, because there's no true cost accounting. It's like, if there's all this externalization of environmental ecosystem services, human health, and so,
well, and somebody needs to go to jail.
Like,
no one goes to jail either. Well, and, so these guys are in communication. When they start a project, they're in communication. They go, well, we'll just have a certain amount. Like up here, we had the Hyundai plant, and they were allowed a certain amount of parts per billion of cyanide to put in the river. So these guys, like you're saying, they already know who the guy is that's going to do the cleanup. So they just go, oh, we'll just tell them that we already have a way to clean it up, and they'll allow us to pollute it in the first place.
And so I think in terms of like how it's implemented and what, this is kind of why I went back to school. So I'm in a PhD right now in environmental toxicology. And the reason I did that is because at the community, trying to do this work on a community level, I just wasn't, I wasn't getting access in a sense. And I was concerned about contributing to gentrification, right? So say that I like work on a project and remediate and improve a contaminated site, typically that would be a shorter term thing, and then that site would become more valuable and would become developed, right? So it's, I went back to school because I think that it's important for all of us who are wanting to advance, these types of strategies to repair ecological and social harm. It's good to use good science and have allies in academic and even like, consulting company kind of groups, just for legitimacy. And so that's something I've grappled with, but I am finding that even being in this academic environment, doing this in a way that is bringing in the same, like trying to bring in the same values and goals, but doing it in a scientifically rigorous way, backed by these respectable institutions, it is getting a little more cred and traction. So that maybe we'll have not only like community hubs of resources for communities to do this work, but those hubs in partnership with academic and scientific institutions, so that it can be done in a way that creates jobs for folks, and also like is done in a good way and taken seriously.
Well, but hopefully stops people from polluting in the first place too, because they will have the information and facts support stopping polluting.
Exactly.
And it would be too expensive. I suppose the scientists could also testify in court about someone's negligence, how negligent someone was.
Yeah. And I mean, I think on that point, something I've found from doing this work is that if there's a massive amount of denial, like everyone wants to deny that there is this pollution problem because those responsible are concerned about liability and don't want to have to pay for it, right? And so I've actually found that engaging folks like the projects I've worked on where we've engaged communities in remediation efforts, what I love about it is that it leads people to ask questions. Like the first thing is people find out that there's, you know, arsenic in their soil where their kids are playing, and then they're like, oh no. And then they're like, wait, like what do we do? We got to do something. And then they're like, wait, how did this get here? Wait, where is this coming from? And then I've been in facilitated workshops where I've seen rooms of like 30, 50 people start brainstorming together like, oh man, I through this workshop learned that this type of contaminant comes from, exhaust. And so, you know, there's like an Amazon facility nearby and there's been a massive increase in like freight. And so it's probably contributing to this. Or like, oh, there's that plant across the river that, so it's like I do think it's good to do this work because actually it's not only complementary to, like you say, kind of stopping the pollution in the first place, but it actually can lead to that because sometimes people need to get, you know, empowered, I think is the big thing. I think like there can be this like systemic just shutting down when we don't feel like there's anything we can do, right? So it's like, why bother? It's depressing to acknowledge all the toxicity, but with these kind of like bioremediation options, it gives, I've seen it, and for me personally, it's been really empowering because then it's like, oh, maybe there's something we can do. And then
it gives me
hope. Kind of like,
I mean, when the horizon, I was going nuts when the horizon thing was leaking, but I know that technology we can at least probably fix it.
Right.
Well, and so you're saying though these scientists will be available for these groups to support them with information that they can then use to push these other factions into doing the right thing.
Exactly. Yeah, it's information. It's like kind of backup, like in terms of reputation, like saying you have a toxicologist on your team, you know, that's pretty legit in court or whatever.
Yeah.
And active proper testing, again, that's so expensive. But if you have an academic partner, a scientific partner, where you can access that ongoing testing, it's evidence, right? That, again, the type of evidence that would hold up in court or be relevant in some kind of case. So I really advocate for those kind of partnerships. I hope to be that person. That's why I came back to school, so that I can be that environmental toxicologist that community groups can call on when they're, you know, trying to fight a development or an industry in their area.
You're the one Aaron Brockovich calls when the chromium. All right, so let's move on because we're coming up. We're running. We got about 20 minutes to go here. So I was listening to Science Friday one day and they had the nanobot guy on and I wrote him and said, my bacteria will eat your nanobots. I mean, because ultimately bacteria will win. It may take a while. And, you know, they just invented, I heard, they invented a machine that does photosynthesis, finally. It's taken them years to do this, but it still doesn't do everything that a plant does. If they ever came up with something that did all the stuff a plant would do, it would be a plant. I mean, why waste time trying to come up with a mechanical plant when you already have the plants right there? Isn't it more efficient to find things in nature that have evolved over the millennia to perform certain functions rather than, you know, reinvent the wheel?
Yeah, I completely agree. And actually, the way that I approach remediation is aligned with that. And it's different than how some people approach remediation, where, you know, people are like making GMO, you know, like for her remediation capability and things like that, or just introducing new, you know, species into an area because of their remediation capabilities. Whereas my approach is to actually work with what's present on the contaminated site. I mean, there's going to be bacteria, fungi, like tons of microbes, probably like worms, you know, probably a bunch of plants that have shown up on their own. They volunteered to be there in those site conditions and to eat and live with the contaminants that are present. So my approach and what I advocate for and recommend is that people actually really get to know the, like, who's there, the microbes, especially in plants that are present on a contaminated site, and ask yourself, like, how can you amplify the work that they're already doing? How can you give them what they need and support them so that they can be even faster or, like, stronger at, you know, breaking down those hydrocarbons and creating soil and, you know, sucking up metals or immobilizing them and things like that.
Well, so you answered my next question, but can you actually see that these organisms like doing this, that they actually like, I mean, these are living organisms, right? A fungi is not a plant or an animal, right? Can you see in their growth that they're happy? In other words, you know, can you tell that they enjoy taking up these toxins?
Yeah, again, I really appreciate that question. And so I'll answer with an example. So basically, so all of these processes that occur through remediation are actually just the plant or microbes' natural life processes, right? Plants need to extract, you know, nutrient elements and mineral elements from the soil for their life processes, you know? And so they take up, toxic elements in the same way. It's just part of their, it's just, you know, same with, like, decomposer fungi, who just how they get their carbon, you know, that they need for their life processes and to maintain their energy and stuff is to degrade through enzymes that they excrete into their environment the carbon-y stuff that's present. And so, again, like, you know, petroleum products, which we use to make a lot of the organic contaminants that are persistent pollutants, are made out of the same stuff that these decomposer fungi would eat anyways. So when they encounter, you know, I don't know, like, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, you know, from exhaust, you know, on the sides of the highways, in the soil, they're just like, oh, hey, I'll eat that. That's, like, basically, you know, like, dead plants that were compressed for a long time. I'll totally put my enzymes in here, break it down, and extract food. So in that way, my sense is that they would rather just eat, you know, like, a dead plant. Like, they'd rather eat a fallen tree than eat, like, diesel oil. But in a pinch, they'll, if that's what's available, they will apply their enzymes and break it down in the same way they would a dead tree. And so, yeah, and I mean, some are more, I guess, happy than others, right? So there's different species that are just more, you know, more down to,
they don't care,
to go to work at transforming contaminants or dealing with metals than others. Like, some of them even, like, some fungi even incorporate toxic metals into their fungal mycelium on the outside as protection from predation. So, you know, some of them are super down and they're like, yeah, I'll work with this, I'll eat it. And then others are less so. And what you can do is look for the species, but also the varieties within a species, like the strains that you're like, wow, this one just got, like, I've had experiences, you know, I had a spawn business, right, mushroom spawn, and so I won't lie, like, I've had weird experiences where I, like, accidentally forgot, you know, a petri dish of you know, of fungi or like some mycelium in a bag, you know, and then went and found it again later and saw that it had fully eaten through stuff like my passport and like, you know, like, I don't know, like my shoes and like a plastic bag or like a painted, you know, piece of wood. Like, so yeah, if you see some kind of something growing on a very toxic material, I would definitely pay attention to that and say, oh, this, you know, this one is uniquely psyched to like work with this toxicity.
Yeah, I don't suppose any of them would take up radiation. We have a Hanford up here in Washington, and there's also Japan, you know, with their nuclear problem there. There's nothing, I don't suppose they'd take up radiation.
Oh, they sure do. Actually, like, fungi have been found growing inside of the melted reactors in Chernobyl.
Wow.
What's amazing is that, you know, plants are really supposed to be the only organisms that can basically convert light into energy. But the fungi found in the melted down reactors have shown to be able to like basically make energy from the radiation. So that's amazing. But another thing to watch out for is that a lot of fungi actually hyperaccumulate radioactive metals into their fruit bodies. Sometimes they'll hold them for long periods of time in the mycelium, in the organism underground, which is helping us, you know, because it's not as available for us to be exposed to it. But yeah, but they can be channeled up into the mushrooms, including ones that people like to eat and harvest from the forest.
Which would be a bad thing to get. You'd be eating radiation.
Yeah, we don't want people eating those. Yeah.
Which just reminds me of, I'm looking into a bacterial battery where the bacteria use waste in the soil to create electricity. They eat the... Yeah, it's a bacterial battery. If you looked at it, there's another name for it. But, yeah. Anyway, So I wonder if they could do something like that, turn radiation into energy. You said they turn radiation into energy. Maybe there's a way to tap that. But in a story, you know, I don't know if you're familiar. You know who Terrence McKenna is? Terrence McKenna said that we're here to spread these plants. We're here as a steward of these plants. We're here for the plants. It's not the other way around. The plants aren't here for us. So, but there's a symbiotic relationship there. So, so is there a Frankenstein situation though? What if these organisms run out of things to clean up? Are they gonna take over the world looking for stuff to eat?
Yeah.
Can they get out of control?
I mean, they're incredibly adaptable. I've really witnessed that working with fungi. They're incredibly adaptable, I've no doubt. But I think a difference, you know, there's so much diversity within the fungal kingdom. So there are some that are parasitic, like the cordyceps that are kind of zombie fungi. Like they basically take over the brains of different insects and make them want to crawl really up high, and then they fruit out of their brains and spread spores, and you know, so there's parasites for sure within the fungi. There's decomposers, but then there's also the symbionts, right? Like the mycorrhizae and the endophytic fungi that are like, hey, what can I do for you? How can we help each other? You know, let's like form a lifelong relationship. So that's mutually beneficial. So there's a lot of diversity within the fungal kingdom, maybe, you know, and a lot of adaptability. And I think that a lot of fungi, I mean, it's been disappointing that there's been so much fear around fungi and misunderstanding, because really within this kingdom of life, there's a lot of fungi that I get the sense approach life on this earth as like, you know, thinking of the greater system and always, like, seeking to form mutually beneficial relationships or, you know, I think there's a, yeah, so,
Well, we know what you're going to be for Halloween. So, you're going to be a parasitic fungi for Halloween, right?
I've seen some really awesome cordyceps costumes. I've actually always wanted to be, it's a partner costume, though. I haven't never found anyone yet to be a mycorrhizal fungal plant with me, so someone would have to be the plant. I kind of wanted to be the fungus, so basically someone would be a tree, and then they would keep giving me candy, sugar, that's how the trade works, and then I would give them water and, like, nutritious food, and that's how it could work. And I'm also protective, right? So I'd be, like, a little bit of a bodyguard.
So I looked up CO2, and what, just during the pinning process, they give off CO2, so that's a greenhouse gas, so... Do they give off, are they going to be giving off greenhouse gases while they're doing their thing?
Oh, yeah, so a lot of fungi are like us. You're right. So they actually need oxygen, and then they expire CO2. And so, but the thing, it's a little complex because, yeah, they, like, mycelium expels CO2, but... there's actually been a lot of recent research coming out about how fungal networks in the soil actually sink carbon in the soil in a number of ways. So certain fungi, some of the mycorrhizal ones, the plant friend ones like I studied, actually play really important roles in the carbon cycle. Just the one type of mycorrhizal fungi that I study is thought to be responsible for 1/3 of global soil carbon sequestration.
Wow.
So pretty significant, yeah.
Well, that's the world's largest organism you're talking about, right? That lives in the forest. Well, before we get to that, though, real quick, can they live in salt water? In other words, you know, for the horizon oil spills and things like that, is there ones that work in salt water?
Yeah, so there are some aquatic fungi that live in the sea, for sure. And then there's some fungi that are just more salt tolerant than others. But, you know, the thing with cleaning up from an oil spill with fungi is that, people usually think, oh, we need to put, like, oyster mushrooms in there because they're really good at degrading oil. But oyster mushrooms aren't really great at living in the ocean or tolerating salt necessarily. So you got to get the oil into some organic material on land so that the oyster can go to work on it, or look for species and strains of fungi that are more, that can degrade hydrocarbons, but also are salt tolerant or even live in aquatic saline conditions.
All right, so going back to, you said that this organism is responsible for 1/3 of the world's carbon sequestration. That's different than the, I can't remember what this thing is called, I should have looked it up. The organism that lives under our trees up here and... Go on, I'm sorry.
Yeah, you got it. So the one that lives in Oregon is actually a Armorillia. It's like a honey mushroom mycelium. So honey mushroom is like, it's actually a parasitic fungus. It acts as a decomposer too, but it'll take down it'll take down trees and forests and to get its food, basically. But, up in Oregon, y'all have the largest, oldest living organism on Earth. It's this giant mycelial network below the ground is thousands of years old and thousands of hectares big. And, you know, it's alive like us. You know, it's interacting with its environment.
So it acts as a highway. And then they're finding out new stuff about this thing all the time, right? And it acts... I've heard that it acts as a highway for nutrients. When one area of trees is deficient, it'll actually help send stuff to that area. Is that right?
Yeah, it's super cool. You can check out the concept of mother trees from Suzanne Simard up in Vancouver, British Columbia. So there's new work coming out where you'll have the study I saw, there was a birch tree. They shaded it out and couldn't photosynthesize. And then through the mycelial network, the fungal network underground, connecting to the roots of that birch tree and connecting all the trees and plants in the forest, necessary carbon was channeled from a Douglas fir tree nearby, completely different type of tree, not in the same family or anything. Carbon was channeled through the mycelial network to help that birch survive. And that happens with, it's been observed with kind of like parent trees, where you'll have a tree drop a cone or something or a seed, that seedling grows, and through the mycelial network, you know, it gets extra nutrients and help, helping it survive, whereas otherwise, you know, it'd be harder. It's shaded out maybe by the tree canopy and there's less space or less nutrients. So, yeah, it's a really fascinating learning about how this fungal network connects ecosystems through connecting the plants. And it's not just the plants. There's interactions between bacteria and fungi, like nitrogen-fixing bacteria and different fungi. There's interactions with all the, the insects, including pathogens, where, you know, through the fungal network, trees on one side of a forest will get a bit of a heads up, like, hey, you better get your defenses ready. We got a pathogen coming.
Well, so aren't they finding these all over the world? It's not just here in Oregon, is it?
No, fungal mycelium is in the ground beneath our feet, like in the tundra, in the desert, in the grasslands, in the forests, all around the world, unless they've been severely disturbed.
All right, let's get to your website. We've got to wrap it up. So your website is DIY Fungi. So you're not doing mushroom plugs anymore, huh?
Not plugs. I do liquid cultures right now. More of a focus on teaching people how to grow their own and make their own spawn.
Yeah, and my question, too, was, can I buy a mushroom log, you know, a shiitake mushroom log, and then over the years, can I just lay it on a pile of oak logs and it would take over the pile of oak logs? It doesn't work that way?
Yeah, I mean, that might work. It'd be slower than and a little more up to chance than, than intentionally inoculating those. What you could do is get a, I have a bunch of handouts on my blog. I have one on mushrooms.
All right, I've been talking to Danielle Stevenson, a PhD student at Riverside, applied mycologist, who is the founder of DIY Fungi and is working on mycoremediation using fungi and mushrooms to take toxins out of the soil. So anything else you want to say?
Okay, I'm sorry. Well, anyways, it's been a great conversation. I teach a lot of workshops and do trainings and work on a lot of projects, so always open to collaboration. I do consultation and education, and I do sell some mushroom cultures. So feel free to hit me up through my blog, diyfungi.blog. And thanks so much for the great conversation.
All right, Danielle Stevenson, thank you for your time. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
This has been Talk is Cheap, KEPW LP, 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kepw.org. So here's a tune about mushrooms with sans profanity.
sit. My desolate room. No lights. No music. Just ever. Killed everyone. I'm away forever. But I'm feeling better. How do I feel? What do I say? You know it all goes away. How do I feel? What do I say?
As community radio, we are all volunteer, and I'm asking you if you could be willing to consider becoming a volunteer. There are several areas: programming, news and public affairs, production, promotion, and fundraising. You can check our website for further details at kepw.org. As community radio, we are all volunteer, and I'm asking you if you could be willing to consider becoming a volunteer. There are several areas: programming, news and public affairs, production, promotion, and fundraising. You can check our website for further details at kepw.org.
You are listening to KEPW LP 97.